Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody truly believes, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Raised in Chihuahua, Mexico, Adrián Tarraza González grew up surrounded by the traditional music of Central America, from danzón, boleros, rumba, to son and mambo. He began developing his musical abilities starting at the age of 11. He was inclined to play the flute and tenor sax with an understanding of classical music and a distinct attraction to jazz, and 5 years later, chose to take on the clarinet. His grandmother, a danzón nut, as he would say, urged her grandson in that direction, but the young player was adamant towards a newfound paragon for himself, namely Hubert Laws. In May of 2002, Tarrajas González was diagnosed with cancer that spread to his stomach and abdomen, and the treatments that he underwent included surgery, extensive radiation treatments for those areas. And in 2004, he was declared cancer-free, and in the same year, another victory for him. He joined the band The Mars Volta as a full-fledged member, an incredible band, and we'll talk about that. From the Mars Volta era, where he won his first Grammy in 2008. He's done that all the way from that to alternate metal to chamber music. He's doing all kinds of soundtracks now. His professional involvement in the music industry has continued to develop in Los Angeles, leading Tram, which is one of the power quartets out there, one of the strongest lineups in music. This dignified and prolific musician collaborates with an eclectic number of international musicians, tours internationally, on an intense and annual schedule with endless collaborations, all the while teaching workshops to numerous school districts and universities around the globe. Adrián, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time. You're incredible, and I'm sorry if I butchered some of those words. I apologize, but thank you for taking the time to be here with us.
Man, not as much as going to butcher all this. Every single English word in the next hour. I was going to say that usually when I'm stationed there, I lived in Los Angeles for more than 17 years, and I moved to Austin, Texas 2 years ago, two Christmases ago. Mm-hmm. And but I've been in Mexico City for the past 2 years working on this video and the music for this video game for Xbox. Mm-hmm. So I just want to at front, you know, not apologize to your listeners for my extra spiciness and my accent, you know. And so usually I'm a little more eloquent on my pronunciation, but right now I've been speaking Spanish, very little English for the past 2 years, but yeah, man, don't worry about it. Terrazas is a hard one because you have the rolling R plus the Z. It just means terrace. That's what it means. It's a terrace, like a house. it's a plural for terrace. And then Gonzalez, you know, it's like Speedy Gonzalez, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but don't worry about it. Adrián is fine, and that's how the guy's going. But yeah, man, thank you for inviting me. I'm a big fan.
Please, thank you.
So, anyways, man, what do you want to know?
Oh man, there's.
I'm sorry, I'm pounding coffee, but I've been pulling this from 3 p.m. to 5 a.m. The writing.
Okay.
Doing the writing for this video game because I had to the finals for the Brazil platform and Xbox needs to be done by the end of this month, and I'm mastering some of the other stuff for the same project.
Excellent.
So I'm sleeping very little. So I'm pounding coffee like a motherfucker.
Man, get that coffee, get it in. And like I said, you're so busy and yet you still agree to do this. So
no,
I'm honored by this.
If you would have told me this a year ago, I would have done it like every other week. Every other week. Nah, man, I'm serious, man. I'm serious. I love talking to people like that, like you, man.
Yeah. No, I love the conversations with you.
So you're ex-military, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
I was in the light infantry with 10th Mountain Light Infantry Division. And when we were preparing to deploy, that's when I got injured. And that's when I went through all that stuff. And you heard my conversation with Lee. So you know that adversity that kind of binds us and how much it influences us as humans, but also it imprints on us as musicians. And
correct.
I play the guitar, but I'm not a musician like you or Lee or anybody in your other bands. But I would love to know, what was it, Hubert Laws? Is that the musician that you heard where you said, I have to play?
Yeah. Like,
I have to play the saxophone, right? Tell me about that experience.
That's a good question. That's a great question because I'm a flautist primarily, not a saxophonist.
Right.
So Hubert Laws is a flautist. His brother was a saxophonist. Ronnie Laws. Mm. So yeah, my inclination was to play orchestral flute like he did. And I didn't know much about him. My grandmother would listen to a lot of the college public radio because she loved classical music and danzón music. But, you know, that's pretty much what you listen to on the radio back in the days. And obviously from where I'm from, I'm Tejano, so a bunch of Tex-Mex stuff and Norteño stuff. And, you know, you're in the infantry, I'm sure you hear some of that stuff. With your comrades. And Sinaloense banda stuff. And, you know, but yeah, one of the flautists, I guess the radio guy loved his playing or something because he will play a lot of his orchestral playing. He will play a lot with the New York Philharmonic as a soloist. And Hubert Laws was one of the first African-American principal flautists for orchestral playing.
Wow.
But he did a lot of jazz with his brother and Chick Corea and Stanley Clark. He did Paul Jackson and Paul Jackson Jr. Paul Jackson Jr., I think he's the guitarist and Paul Jackson is the bassist during the fusion-ish era of jazz, you know, when Weather Report started popping out of the, you know, Yellow Jackets and so forth and so on. But I didn't know he was black. I just thought it was some German dude, you know, playing the shit out of the flute, you know, especially for rock music. That was my real love for music and was inclined to baroque music. Until this day, I try to break my year where I'm playing at least 40% of the year some chamber concerts. And I do some clarinet, mostly flute, and some classical playing on the saxophone, of more legit playing as we call it on the academic world, you know.
Yeah.
And so I started writing some more stuff for me to play either flute or saxophone, but my own orchestral arrangements. I actually did two of the tram songs for chamber orchestra and saxophone, hoping that either Tosin or Javier will fly to Mexico and actually play the songs with orchestra, but with no drums, which is kind of hard for me because I really love
percussion.
I mean, you can have metal without drums, but the way I wrote them, it worked. It works without drums. So yeah, so I asked my grandmother to call the DJ at the college booth, and yeah, the guy said, "Yeah, man, get some black CDs, and I'll burn a bunch of music for him."
Wow!
And I got a bunch of classical and baroque music, mostly all flute, or full flute performances by Hubert Laws, and then he did burn a CD with Hubert Laws playing with Chick Corea.
Chick Corea, wow.
Yeah, and his brother playing bassoon and tenor saxophone. And I was like, oh, that sounds great, man. So I got a flute from a pawn shop and I started shedding on that. I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't have a teacher. So I went to the library, got a fingering chart and a children's flute book for transverse flute, orchestral flute that is. And I shared on that. I will ask different musicians or around the town, you know, how to do the embouchure on the flute and blah blah. And that's it. I would just go to the music school and chat with the guys and they were taking lessons. Because I didn't get any money for lessons. Yeah, so, you know, I would just chat with them and then ask them, you know, hey, how you do this? How you play this? How you position F sharp? How you do this? Or what, you know, was it the real way, the actual way to grab this instrument? And so that's how I learned. And that's how I learned clarinet. And that's how I learned saxophone, you know. And all my instruments were gathered from pawn shops. So that... So that's it. And so I started, you know, I was very, very good by picking up the woodwind. The woodwinds made sense to me for some reason. It just made sense. So I will pick up a clarinet and I will be like, I just give me the fingering chart. And 2 months later, I was playing Tejano music with a clarinet.
Wow.
You know, I'm not going to say I was the best, but I was, you know. But I did the gigs and I got paid for it.
There you go. Professional musician. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. My first professional gig, so-called professional gig, was playing a quinceañera. With this band called La División, which is a wedding band. And I will play clarinet and my tenor saxophone. And then I will go back home and pick up the flute as a... That was my legit instrument. That was my vision of me trying to be a solo instrumentalist, a concert musician, so-called, you know? And then the other instrument will be just fun, you know?
Right.
The clarinet will be, I play norteño with this and I play, you know, a little bit of jazz. I didn't know what I was doing. I would just learn the jazz, I don't know. Learn The Girl from Ipanema or Take Five or whatever, all the songs they want to hear in a wedding, you know. Or I just remember I did play for a lobby bar of a hotel of one of my parents' friends or something like that. So my mom and my aunt, one of my aunts will go in and make sure I wasn't drinking because I was 15.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was 15 playing with these older dudes.
Wow.
Which two of the other dudes were doing more than just drinking. So they wanted to just make sure I will get paid or then I wasn't doing any funky shit, you know. No, but I didn't drink or anything like that. I never been a drinker. Never been a drinker. Since I never been a drinker nor I never try any hard drug, I still don't know what doing coke feels like.
Yeah.
I still don't know how, you know, doing amphetamines or whatever. Yeah. I did try pot and I do microdosing, but I never tried any hard drug and I never been an alcoholic. I think I got drunk like 4 times in my life.
Wow.
And I got tipsy twice because the only time I drink is when I cook for my girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, but since I don't drink, I get you know, I drink a pint, I drink a Guinness and I'm
exactly.
I'm ready. I'm lightweight. Fucking lightweight.
I think that's awesome because that I believe that is what's allowed you to continue to evolve and grow as a musician. Because how many musicians do we know from that scene where, again, we talked to Lee, like it literally almost killed him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we see a lot of people along the side of the road that were incredible or they had, you know, they kind of arrived and they did a good job and they had a couple of albums or whatever. And then they didn't realize that that's not sustainable or that it actually starts to have a detrimental effect on, again, your motor skills. Like you can't finger correctly if you've had too much or.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And I think that's a part that people don't always see in the music business.
Yeah. It's like Dr. Andrew Huberman says. It's not as one thing, then alcohol is good for you. Besides that, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, that is good for you.
Yeah.
You know, if you want red wine for antioxidants, I can name you millions of freaking fruits or vegetables that have antioxidants, or just eat meat, and, you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, but it is fun. I understand, you know. I never understood it. I think it's because my dad died of cirrhosis. My dad died because he was an alcoholic. He was hardcore alcoholic, and he didn't have the will to stop. So he died. He died, I think I was 28 when I was coming back. We were coming back from a Volta tour from Japan. We did a full month in Japan. And when I landed, I looked at my BlackBerry. Remember those things?
Oh, yeah. And, I remember those things.
Yeah. And I had like over 30 messages saying, but I never had a relationship with my dad. I saw my dad. I had maybe 4 conversations with him face to face and 2 on the phone. So 2 on the phone when I was in college. And that was it. And then when I got the call from my grandmother, saying so I didn't have that relationship. And then my granddad, my mother's father, was also a hardcore alcoholic, but he did stop. So he lived his last 20 years of his life sober. But by then, you know, he had lost my grandmother. He lost part of his wealth, and so it's hard. It was probably very hard for a 50-year-old guy that is sober now to start over and see that what alcohol did to him, you know. But again, it was, you know. And then my mother's only brother, he did hardcore drugs, hardcore alcohol. So for me, I was raised by my grandmother, and a single mother. My mother's first marriage was at my 15th birthday. Was like almost on my 30th birthday. And she has a great, great marriage. And from a solid dude, my stepdad is a great, great dude. But I got to see that when I was already a teenager. So I had 15 years of fucking chaos with dudes, you know? Yeah. The only solid dudes were the people at my great-granddad's ranch, because my great-granddad didn't drink. And the guy is working at the ranch or the farm. So that gave me stability of like, okay, those are the dudes work from 5 a.m. to freaking from 5 p.m. hard work. And then my grandmother will be like, do your homework, don't blah, blah, blah. Leave the room. Don't leave the room until it's clean, blah, all those things, you know?
Excellent.
So yeah, so I guess I just did the math. Okay, A plus B gives you that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not going to drink. So my first drink, I was already in college, probably 21, 22. Wow.
And so, see, I had a similar experience. And it's interesting where we can have something like that happen in our life. And for some people,
correct. We
understand that doesn't make any sense. I don't want to do that. But other people see it and they say, oh, this is what a man's supposed to do.
Correct.
And then they catch themselves sort of falling down that. But like I said, I don't think you would be the success that you are had you tried to do those things. Or again, we see some musicians that try to hold it together. But again, it's a matter of time. They're a ticking time bomb, and then they eventually have to face it. I have even more respect for you now, knowing that you're doing this all with just a cold blood in your veins and not having to drink to get to that place.
Well, to be fair, I mean, you probably read some musicians' biographies. Have you read Beneath the Underdog? Ah, man, I truly recommend it. It's probably one of the most beautiful written books. It was written by Charles Mingus.
Okay.
It's his autobiography. And if you put yourself in their shoes back in the early, you know, late 40s, 50s, 60s, early 60s, then I will probably drink too.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't matter your race, man. It didn't matter you're Mexican, white, black. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
Man, everybody had it hard.
Yes.
Everybody had it hard. So, and they were a different breed of people, for sure.
Yeah.
Everyone. Yeah. And our parents are their kids, you know?
Yes.
Their grandkids. So I mean, you gotta put things into perspective. And I come from a very, very hard environment, hard, macho, you know, cowboy, this and that. And it's a lot, but it's a lot of narco stuff and sicario stuff. You know, it's a lot of that because of the, yeah. I'm Chihuahua, Mexico. My hometown is just 4 hours from the border of El Paso, El Paso, Texas. Yeah. And we have New Mexico. We have Las Cruces, New Mexico. And then you drive east, you will get Laredo, or you will get the, you know, close to San Antonio. So it's a lot of drugs coming in and out, yeah. And you're just in the middle of it. So it's a lot of shootings every now and then, you know, it's a lot of that.
Right.
It used to be that way. It's not that way anymore.
Because the cartel had so much control back then.
Yeah. But, you know, I think they got smarter. So they just go through politics now.
Yep.
You know, back in the days, it was like cowboys and Indians, man.
Yeah. Yeah, there was war in the streets all the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So those type of environments, you know, they give you a perspective of how it used to be. And even though I had that type of hardship, and I came from a single grandmother and single mother family who worked their asses off to somewhat provide for me, you know, as a child, I guess that's why I'm trying to find a job right away. Oh, I can do this well. You know, I just going to keep practicing, and then I got little gigs here and there. And then I will like, hey, I will buy this, or I will buy little groceries, or, or I mean, it wasn't much, but when, you know, as a male figure, you know, I felt like I needed to do that, you know, until my mother got married, and then things got a little easier as time went on. But I, you know, I'm no one to be judging those Charlie Parker for dying of a heroin overdose, right, or Jimi Hendrix for doing the same, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I didn't live that life. And I didn't want any, I don't know. I'm not that type of dude. And it's easier to say no to things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's better to resist the bait than struggle the snare once you're in it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's why my grandmother was very, very, she was extremely a strong woman, and she lived lived a very hard life. I felt like I didn't have any excuses for me to not do the jobs, or to do a job, or to study, or to do well in school, or to, you know, even though I had it hard, right. I didn't feel like I had it hard, because my grandmother was like, hey, you had a roof on your top and you have food. Yeah. What are your excuse? Yeah. You know? What's your excuse? Yeah. You know? Do your fucking homework.
It's not that hard. Just, we're letting you live here. Do your homework.
Exactly. But you can derail very easily, you know, as a young lady. You know? But music, it was too fun. And I had so much fun transcribing jazz musicians, and I got very much into hip hop at a very young age. So I really loved how J. Dilla did things. And I used to love Biggie's, I still do, but Biggie's old albums, how they were made. And so I will research who was doing the beats, and then when they do collaborations with Wu-Tang Clan, and I was like, oh, you know, for me, it was like a whole different world outside of classical music.
Yeah.
So what I'm going with this is that music will be just one thing. It didn't matter if it was me practicing Bach sonatas or transcribing how J. Dilla did beats, or, you know, or transcribing or learning a Charlie Parker solo, you know.
And I think that that's so powerful, yeah, because people claim that they're eclectic.
Yeah.
Because they can play a diminished arpeggio over here and then, you know, something in E flat. But it's not exact like what you're describing is truly, because I don't think people understand classical music. Like, a lot of times it's very much like it's in a box. You don't have a lot of freedom. There's a lot of technical prowess required to get to that place where you can execute to that skill set. And you were influenced by that, but then you were able to bring the discipline of that by playing by ear to hear Charlie Parker, to understand what Coltrane was doing, like putting all those things together. And now being able to say, I can take the flat seventh of this, put it over this minor, and now solo in this, and all of a sudden you get this beautiful jazz tone that would be sort of frowned upon in classical music, but you were able to do that. So when you were in those places, you're a master of this. So, but if I could ask you, what is your process like when you were looking back at those kind of things where, because you just kind of go now, you don't have to think about it, but if you could describe a process, what would that look like? Or how do you approach some of these things when you're going into different genres of music or different inspirations for that performance?
Oh man, that's such a great question. I think to me, it was every time a friend, a colleague of mine. Okay, I'm gonna tell you the first time I played metal.
Okay,
it was these guys from my hometown. They used to be a Pantera cover band.
Okay, that's pretty heavy. Okay.
That's pretty heavy. I didn't know shit about Pantera. You know, just like a lot of our generation kids, we love Iron Maiden, but because it was, the covers were so fucking cool.
Yes.
They were like, I don't know what the hell this is, but the vinyl covers were great.
Yes.
Like every album was like, but anyways, so that was my metal world. They're like either Dio or Megadeth. I still love fucking Megadeth. Mm-hmm. I saw him like 5 years ago, but
wow.
But man, their son is so beautiful. But anyways, so this band will, you know, will do every now and then their own metal songs, reminiscent a little bit of the of Pantera-ish, you know, because that's when that genre really came in, like during the 90s. It was
the early, late 80s, early 90s. It was so heavy. It was so in your face. It just like punched you.
Exactly. Because everybody was used to just, like I say, Megadeth or Poison or Def Leppard, things like that. You're like, oh yeah, that's heavy metal. And then Pantera came in and Slayer came in. And all those guys were like, whoa.
Yeah. The
hardcore guitar shredding riffs, you know, super flashy drums with double,
the double bass going,
I mean, I guess you can tell, you can say the double bass was already in, but not like this. Not bass drum, not double bass drum playing in unison with guitar riffs.
Mm-hmm.
No, none of that. Yeah. None of that.
It's like a machine gun going off.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, Pantera and Slayer were some of those pioneers, you know? And so they were doing their songs. They were like, and I played little keyboards. So that's how I was playing with these guys. And then they told me, hey, you play saxophone, right? You're like, yeah. Maybe a little saxophone and this thing will be great. I'm like, sure, I'll bring it. So I would, you know, I would learn the guitar lines on the saxophone. So I was just trying to figure out how to fit whatever I was, you know, with my little dexterity that I had already gathered throughout those first 4 years of me practicing, and then just shedding all that. And I would just play and trying to figure. I didn't know much harmony until I really started studying theory on my own at the age of 15. But I'm talking, I was 13, man. I was 12 when I was playing with these guys, and I was trying to learn those lines, and I was like, man, the guitar and saxophones together sounds great.
Yeah.
And we were out of tune for sure. We were out of tune. But for some reason, I never played in unison with a guitar, with an electronic instrument, you know, those type of lines, you know. For me, it was just like Charlie Parker this, you know, bebop, or, you know, classical lines, or baroque lines, or arpeggios, whatever, you know, whatnot. So I was like, man, this is fun. You know, this is fun. So I would, you know, every, I guess the word got out. So every musician, every band will be like, hey, I have a salsa band. You know, like, I never play salsa, but let's go. But everything's written. Everything's written. But they'll be like, hey, solo on this section. Solo? I don't know. What key is it in? you know, like you said, I think it's easy, you know, like it's just, so your ears start, you start yes. doing a little retraining. I think that's G. And then, you know, playing the flute. And so that's when I started bringing the flute into the gigs, because it's a lot of flute in salsa music. And then they will call me for Tejano things, you know, so I will play that. And then I remember this guy that played at this other clarinet player who was much seasoned than I was at the time. He created his own little group. And so he started writing his own music. And so I will try to, you know, incorporate my stuff in that. And if I heard something, you know, like, hey, maybe I should bring my clarinet and not play saxophone there and just play clarinet with this and that, or maybe a little keyboard. So I was just very happy to be in that environment and for them to open the door to our creativity. I mean, I know the songs were, you know, were cheesy probably, but it was a creative environment nonetheless, you know?
Yeah, and it feels like you just love music. You just love performing. You love the process of discovery.
Yeah, yeah.
And so many musicians, like, we get good, or not even good, but we get adequate in a certain style or genre. Mm-hmm. And then they don't want to get out of that because they have to start over and look like an amateur or be out of tune. But you had no fear. You're like, I'll play whatever. Like, whatever's there, I'll bring something to it.
Yeah, and I think that the thing was that I really wanted to fit into whatever they were doing. It's like if somebody asked you to be in their barbecue, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, if you ask me to go into your barbecue, into your house, you know, and you're already grilling, you know what you're doing, I'm not going to go and be like, hey, man, I think you should blah, blah, blah. You know, you're like, hey, wait a minute, dude. Let me do my thing. Mm. But I can be like, hey, why are you cooking, man? Oh, well, I think I'm going to do this, my season then. I'm going to do my meats like that. I'm like, well, maybe I make a couple of salsas and a guacamole and be like, hey, man, I brought that and let me know how it fits, you know, nice. Because that's how I envision it. And you'll be like, well, maybe the guacamole is too much, but the salsa is, you know, the salsa worked, you know. But I'm just trying to add up and fit in whatever you're trying to do. I'm trying to bring up your experience in that moment, you know, with respect, because I knew I was being invited to the party, but I wasn't leading. I wasn't doing this and that, but I was throwing little balls here and there, like, hey, maybe we do this and this and that, you know, it will help or it will work. And they will let me do it. Yeah. You know, some people will be like, nah, just learn this line. And I had to, and that's cool. But it will make me go freaking practice those guitar lines and be proficient about it. And that was cool to me as well, man. I just wanted to be there and make that moment better and just to be part at the stage with them. That's all I wanted to do. And I think that translated throughout my years, because if it wasn't with the Volta or I remember the first time when I recorded Francis the Mute, the album was almost probably at its 90% to be completed. Mm. I think it needed some master, some editing, but everything was done. So I just went and did my saxophones, my flutes, my overdubs, and that was it. Some percussion, because most of the percussion was not live. That album was all the percussion done by Lenny Castro, who was a master.
Yes.
What a freaking, I love that guy. And he was my maestro later on for the upcoming albums. But anyways, he told me, hey, do you mind if we fuck with some effects during your solo? I'm like, sure, man. What kind of effects? Like, I never put effects on any horn then. I didn't know what that was possible. I mean, I knew it was possible because I love Miles Davis, you know, how he did shit with a wah, or sure. the Breaker Brothers. They will have like guitar pedals going into their horns,
right?
Wah, and like they will put wah-wahs or like super chipters.
Yeah, they compress it, make some more. Yeah,
yeah. Synth, they will put through synths or phasers. Yeah. Then they mm-hmm. will put the S90 phaser into the horns. It will be like, oh, that sounds cool. So yeah. I knew that was a thing, but I never tried it. And I was like, man, sure, man, what are you going to put? Well, maybe some echoes, maybe some this and that. I was like, well, can I hear while I'm playing? Like, sure. Like, well, what do you want? Well, let's, you know, I just start recording the solo and then you can pick and choose. I was thinking, this was in New York, by the way. They flew me to the Avatar Records in New York. And I was like, yeah, if I can hear back whatever you're doing, maybe I'll be cool because I never done this before. I had already recorded my flutes, and when I played that solo in Cassandra, because it's two interventions, but it's one solo that is like long.
Yeah,
the one saxophone solo that is long. Like, hey, well, you're starting here and you're not going to end here, or I let you know or I direct you when you're about to end your solo. All right. So I was looking at him, one of the guys at the other side of the booth. So I start playing, and I heard the echoes, the space echo. They were putting the big rack space echo. They just start, and I was like, "Wow, this is cool, man!" It's like I'm hearing the bouncing of the horn, and then at the end of the solo, boom, it just went dry. And that's what I was going nuts. Like,
yeah.
And then he just, I forgot to open my eyes to see where he wanted me to end. And when I opened my eyes, the guys were like, keep going. And that's how I ended all the way to the guitar, play over the guitar riff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the John went going nuts. Now we're just going. Going and then when I opened the door, I opened my eyes, I thought it was like, oh, I totally fucked the record up. They're like, no, keep going.
Wow.
So that was it. So that solo was like, okay, so should I do it again? No, you're done. That's it. Really?
You sure?
I'm fucking, are you sure? Because I hated that solo. I was like, I hate that solo, dude. I played some lines, some Coltrane lines or whatever. But I was just fucking around to see because I was happy that I was getting that feedback.
Yeah.
And all they were like, yeah, that's fine. That's it. I mean, you want to do another pass, it's cool, but we're using this.
Like, you can do all the passes you want, but this is what's going on the album.
This is going to go into the record, you know, like or not. I'm like, all right. So that was it, you know. So that was the first time I, you know, used pedals, and I was cool. When the guys asked me that night, they walked me into my hotel room. They were like, hey, man, are you a drinker? Are you a party? Do you do any drugs? Like, no, man. No. I don't, you know. I mean, I hardly even drink, but I've never done any drugs. I'm like, oh, okay. Because two of the guys, they were trying to get off some hard drugs. And one of their band members had just died due to an overdose, Jeremy. And so I'm like, no, that's cool. So... 4 months had passed. That was 2004. And then their manager called me and like, hey, I think the guys, Omar had already asked me if I want to be in the band. I was like, yeah, sure, I'll give it a try. But when the manager called me and like, hey, are you willing to move to Los Angeles? Are you moving to?
It's official at that point.
It's official. And this and that, you know, like, oh, okay. Now I'm going to have an A1A number and this and that. And all this stuff. So late 2004, I sold all my shit. I grabbed my books, my records, my horns, and I moved on my Toyota to Los Angeles. Oh. And that's it. And I played with the band until we we started having problems. And, you know, right after we got the Grammy, right before we got the Grammy, we started, everybody was, I think we were all fed up. You know, and a couple of guys started doing shady stuff, legal shady stuff. And I'm sure I did some wrong shit as well. You know, we were young and stupid with a rock band. So that's it. That's when we stopped playing. The guys did a few more tours without me, and then I was supposed to go back on tour, but by then the economy was going to shit. You know, when Obama went into, I don't know if you remember, when Obama went into office, woo, the economy was going nuts. Kind of like right now.
Yeah, I see a pattern forming. And I was talking to you about, before we hit record, I saw you guys on Letterman, and the energy is just like palpable. I thought you guys were going to literally tear that studio down for real. Like as they're counting in, like you can feel it.
Yeah.
And then you come on and it's just like, it's like you're breaking out of jail. You're just going. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that power and that energy was crazy. And you were saying how you're like, yeah, we were doing that 2 or 3 hours at a time. Like that was like it's almost like you're in a, like your chops were already incredible, but then once you're there and now you guys are like really locked in and you guys are really tight. Now this just takes the whole experience to this whole other level. Can you tell me about what it was like to be on Letterman? How did that feel? Did you feel like you had arrived at that point as a musician?
No, I got to tell you what I was thinking. During that time, Letterman had a celebrity music guest with their band, with their house band, a music guest, and then his regular two guests, right. You know. So his band celebrity guest was Bruce Willis, and I was a big Bruce Willis fan when I was a kid.
Wow!
I used to watch all his movies, the Die Hard movies. I was like, oh! So the whole time, I was like, forget I was in the Letterman show. I got to see Bruce Willis and say, what's up? I'm like, Bruce, dude, you don't know. Every male figure I had around me, it was cowboy boots, cowboy hat. That's it.
Yeah.
I sent you some pictures of me as a kid with
as a caballero. Yeah.
As a caballero. Yeah. And as a kid with my horse and my, most of the horses that they had around, they were my godfathers because they all had ranch with bulls. But I never seen a movie where the guy had a fedora hat, you know, and then a ring, an earring, you know, and all in black, or you know, with a goatee or this and that, or like 80s Bruce Willis, 80s 90s Bruce Willis was a different beast, man.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, he
was the man.
He was the man. Those type of figures, you know. So for me to see him, you know, with his harmonica singing blues, you know, it took me back to those movies, which were, you know, they're comfort movies, you know, comfort. It's like comfort food, like in a cheeseburger, you know, you're watching Die Hard, like, you know, it's cheesy, you know, but it's, it takes you back to those days, you know, you can smell my grandmother's food. You can see
and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see my mom wearing her a uniform, you know, going to the hospital. And so it brings me back to all that. So going all the way, I mean, to be there at the Letterman show was, it was surreal. That thing went from all being in a band or one tour bus to now have two or three tour buses, having a big crew, management being all over our asses, you know, all the time, and you know, doing these types of interviews. During those years, we did the Henry Rollins show.
Yes.
Have you seen that one? That one was pretty.
I haven't. I'll have to check it out though.
Check it out because that's a whole. We actually played a whole set.
Wow.
The Henry Rollins show was a year or so before Letterman.
Wow.
But that to me was even bigger than Letterman. I love Letterman. Don't get me wrong. And I know the importance of the pop culture importance of being on that show.
Yeah, but Henry Rollins was like a musician that was already...
Exactly.
You already loved him, yeah.
Yeah, and I love Black Flag. And I, for me, Bad Brains and Black Flag, it was like, all that brought me back to high school and in college. And but yeah, to be there, that was the time where the band, we were getting along. We were getting along. You can see the egos popping up little by little, you know, because we were all start getting deals with, I got my deal with Samsung Technologies, and then I got my first deal with Selmer Perez, which is a saxophone maker. And then the guys were, Omar got their deal with Ibanez guitars, and yeah. Juan got his deal with Fender, and another. We all got everything for free. You want pedals? There you go.
Yeah, and it's all custom to the way you want
exactly,
it. Too.
Exactly. Yeah. You have your text, you know, like customizing pedal boards for you, and you can talk to the when you get your sound guy asking, hey, this company really wants you to use their microphones, you know, yeah. They're really into, you know, what you're doing, they probably hated how I played, but they really wanted their microphones for my horn.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you can see that, you know, people getting into magazines, everybody getting hot girlfriends, you know.
Living.
Everybody started getting drinking a little more.
Oh, you're living the dream, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Guys started drinking a little more. But thank God I knew what was happening. It was very vivid for me. You know, it was me looking at my dad for the first time, drunk as hell. Me seeing my dad's brother with a needle in his hand. Like, I knew where this was going. So I start merging myself, going back and only practicing flute. I didn't practice saxophone. I didn't shed Coltrane lines. I didn't shed any of the Joseph Latif books or any of those things. I just went back, read a bunch of classical music, and nothing but classical music. I just practiced classical music on my flute. I will warm up on my horn, on my saxophone, or by bass clarinet. I will play a lot of bass clarinet. I played a lot of bass clarinet during those years. But I went back and I shed on the flute. Like, I was playing a flute concerto in a few months. And every time I went back to LA, I will go to my boys' Muay Thai gym, and I will just share with them.
Yes.
And I started running. We'll get the tour bus will hit the city. Usually, we'll get a lot of the time. We'll get there right before the venue opened. So we will get there, and I'll be like, just hit the espresso machine, and yep. Go run for a few hours.
Nice.
And see the city. It didn't matter if we were in Europe, if we were in Japan, it didn't matter. I would just go and run. I will go to the room, do Tyson push-ups, you know, those things against the wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or practice my Muay Thai stance or something. I didn't really get into jiu-jitsu until I got married. I was married for a few years, and I moved to San Diego. Mm. And one of my colleagues, he started teaching jiu-jitsu, one of his sensei's gyms. So I told him, hey, man, what's all this fuss about jiu-jitsu, you know? And I told him I did judo and I did taekwondo and I've been doing jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, but I really wanted to get into it. So he instructed me at one of the Logan Parks in San Diego, Barrio Logan. You know, you've been to San Diego, correct?
I have, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know Barrio Logan, that area?
Yeah,
yes, area. Very close to the bay. Yes. I mean, your military, so the Coronado Bay is right there.
Mm-hmm.
All the military bases are around that area, surrounded that area. So we used to get together at the park, and he will teach me drills, and we will go, and that's what I got hooked.
Yeah.
So yeah, that kept me, from getting into that something that everybody was getting into. And everybody started drinking a lot. A lot of the band members were drinking a bottle of Don Julio every concert. Things like that. I'm not going to say who, but no, everybody knows who. but everybody knows.
but for you also, before that happened, you had cancer, stomach cancer.
Yeah.
That probably made you understand this is not something that I want to do. And let's be honest, we were discussing earlier with your childhood and how, like, imagine had you been drinking as a young man before you got that, like, you may not have made it.
Yeah. I was living a healthy life. I really, really always enjoyed sports and especially martial arts. So for me, it was easy because what am I going to go to my judo class in college, drunk? No. Or if I really wanted to practice until 5 a.m. because I had a flu recital the next day, or in the next week, I'm pounding coffee. And I don't have money to be drinking. I need to pay my tuition and I need to do all this stuff to pay my bills. I don't have time to be drinking.
Yeah.
So that was clear. So the cancer thing, I think, I don't know. I don't have my dad's history, health history. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that side of my family has a history of cancer from testicular to maybe prostate to maybe stomach to anything, But I was going through a lot of stress because I was studying nonstop. And when I'm about to do something and study and practice and yada, yada, I become a little too obsessed with that person, to that process. So for me, it's like, fuck it. I'm not going to sleep. I'll sleep when I die. that thing, that mentality. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, I need to study this for those courses. And then I still need to practice 4 hours of flute, 3 hours of saxophone, da-da-da-da, and then go play my gigs. And then I took it too hard. So I think I wasn't eating well because, again, I didn't have money to eat well. So I would just do like a little oatmeal with some fruit. But 2 hours later, we're eating cookies with a coffee, or a bagel and a coffee. That's it, And then I will eat well. At the gig, if I was playing a salsa gig, they will feed the band. Yep. And that was it. That was my meal of the day. So if you're not sleeping well, if you're not doing this, it doesn't matter how young you are, man.
Yes.
You're taxing your body heavily, So I think that triggered, maybe, I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
Me neither.
So, exactly. So I don't know. But the good thing is I was getting into lifting a lot of weights. So I was massive. I was just lifting heavy. I was, so I had a lot of muscle mass on me. So I think I was over 240 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, you were
jacked.
I was jacked. Well, it's easier for me because I'm 6'4". I'm lean right now because I'm always on the mat, and I do fast almost every day.
Nice.
Like for instance, I'm not going to eat until at the end of your show. And so I'm very lean and I'm almost as heavy as I used to be then.
Wow.
But the way I train is, it's heavy. Then I was just weights.
Yeah.
Weights. Exactly. And I think that helped me a lot going through radiation and everything because I had a lot of muscle in me. I don't know if I was very thin or if I was overweight, I don't think I would have made it because it was 2 months of heavy radiation.
Yeah.
And you don't keep anything because it's straight to your stomach. It's like your lower stomach. So anything you eat comes out.
Yeah.
So I will do, I will be at 7 in the morning at the oncologist's office, and then blah, blah, blah. They will take me to the, to prep myself for radiation, yada, yada, yada. That was 7 in the morning. So I'll be out like around 10 a.m. Go straight to the, I drew myself the first 3 times. And then I will have friends drive me to the hospital because I will have to stop. Like I will start, you know, it will start getting worse and worse. So I will have to stop and throw up and then keep right driving myself to the, to my apartment. And my girlfriend at the time, she's from Switzerland. She was from Switzerland. She passed away, curiously enough, of stomach cancer early this year, which was a mind-blowing. You know, we became very good friends. She moved to Australia. She had a beautiful marriage. But I never wanted to be that ex-boyfriend to always, you know. But I got a call from one of our college, ex-college buddies, and, she, you know, they told me, they got, you know, they told me the news. And so anyways, during that time, she used to go back home to Switzerland, to Basel, Switzerland, and work with her parents. So my mom drove from Chihuahua, and she will help me out. She's a nurse, so, you know, she knew what to do. But yeah, man, it was tough because from 10 a.m. all the way to, let's say, noon, I was hugging that thing. I was just throwing
the toilet
up.
just giving it all.
I was just making love to the fucking toilet. Yeah. And then I would sleep for an hour or two, and I would just pound water. Yeah. And then I was like, fuck it. You know, I remember Lance Armstrong was, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
One of his books said that he will, as soon as he will feel a little better, he will be just pounding water and either go to small runs or get on the bike, on the stationary bike.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, man, maybe it's not that hard. Or maybe once I feel good, you know, or if I feel a little energy after my nap, I can go take a run. So I will, you know, I will pound some water and I will take little runs. And then I realized I could run for an hour and then 2 hours. And then my mother will be waiting for me with a pot of water. I would just chug that thing in and then eat like a freaking animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I will, you know, I got everything done. So after the second week, after my second week of local radiation therapy, that's what I will do. Come back from therapy.
Wow.
Vomit for 3 hours, sleep for an hour, and then go for a run. Come back, eat, and then I will practice, study, read, whatever, and just get myself situated to do it for the next day. And that was 2 months.
Insane.
And then towards the end of the last month, funny enough, I will get calls to do out of town gigs, rather.
Gigs, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, just so I will get like, hey man, can you do this weekend in Austin, Texas at the Elephant Room? I'm like, let's go. But I will still have the marks in my stomach because I needed to do my radiation therapy on Monday. The radiation therapy is from Monday to Friday. So I will have weekends off. And then I will, you know, they will fly me to San Diego to do a gig or a orchestral gig or whatever. So for some reason, man, the very end tag of my therapy, I started getting calls like a motherfucker, man. And one of those days was with a Volta. I was, I'm going to tell you how we met, how I met the guys. I used to be the music director for our guitar players' dad's salsa band, Omar. His dad, Marcel Rodriguez Chéveres, he was a salsa singer and he got a salsa orchestra. So I used to be I used to be the director for his salsa orchestra. That's how I met the guys.
Wow.
So the guys went to a, salsa festival, like a music, like a street festival there in Texas, you know, Paso, Texas. They were like, oh man, let's call this guy. He plays a lot of instruments. For them, we were like, hey, he plays flute and saxophone. That's a lot of instruments. But in a salsa band, every saxophone player plays flute, or every saxophone player plays clarinet for cumbias, you know? Mm-hmm. But for them, it's like, oh, this guy plays a lot of instruments, so bring him on. And when Ryan recorded Francis the Mute, I still had 1 week when I flew back from New York for my last radiation
therapy.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like, I've never heard of anybody, first of all, wanting to go for a run after throwing up for hours after having radiation. Like, most people are lucky to just be able to sleep at all. You're going for runs for a couple of hours, smashing water like a champ, eating like a beast, and then doing out of town gigs on the weekend, you know, in your spare time. That's insane.
But that's the thing. The other thing was my oncologist wife was a nutritionist and a good one.
Nice.
And she was like, let's just try to eat just meat and avocado. Don't do tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Don't do, what is it called, bananas or anything too acidic.
Because all that stuff is acidic and it inflames you, right?
Exactly. And I was like, all right. Salt, meat, avocado. That's it. Got it. You know, olive oil on top of that. That's it. And it was easy for me because I come from a rancher's background. Yeah. So eating meat all day is all good. But the running thing, don't get me wrong. The first time I went running, I think I lasted 15 minutes. All right. And then I, you know, by my ego was like, okay, I'm going to walk the rest of the hour, you know, because I don't know if you've been to El Paso, Texas, but it has a beautiful sun.
Yeah.
The sun is right in your face.
Yeah.
But it felt good, man. The sun, it was like, oh man, like, this feels so good. I came back, drank my water. And then I did it the next day. And then my body was like, I could probably run a little 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. Man, by the end of that month, I was already running the hour and 50 minutes. And then before the therapy ended, I was running 2 hours easily. I lost a lot of muscle, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But my stamina was up the roof. And I don't know, and I had very good people around me at that time, you know, during those years. But they say that you never know when the great opportunity is knock on your door. And you're not, I told my students, practice like a freaking maniac and do your work like a freaking maniac, because you probably are going to be sick. Your stomach, you're probably going to have a fever, or you're going to have a stomachache the first time they called you to play at the Carnegie Hall, or you play your first concert for 20 people, for 20,000 people. You know, you never know, man. You never know. And it's not going to be the best day of your life. It's going to be the best opportunity of your life, but it's not going to be the best day of your life anatomically. What is it called?
Physically.
Physically,
exactly. Because every opportunity has adversity that you have to pay to get there.
But anyways, hopefully it is, everything goes as planned and you feel great and that day is good and dandy. But
that's incredible.
Yeah.
So you go from that, become an official member of the Mars Volta, and then tell me what it's like to win a Grammy. Tell me how it felt. Tell me, did it blow your mind? Did it just seem like it was natural? How does that feel?
Fucking surreal, man. Because I got in the mail the invitation to go into the Grammys. Like, and then I called our manager, like, oh, what is this? I was very bad with emails. So I read your freaking email. So I look at the email, I'm like, oh, we are part of, we are being,
yeah,
we got nominated for, you know, against these bands and, you know, for hard rock performances. And that's it. After we come back from Japan, I think we have 2 days off, and then we go straight to the Staples Center to the Grammys to do this thing. I'm like, all right, let's go. And but I thought, you know, like, are we gonna go, you know, do this, do the rock star thing and go home, and that's it, you know, drink a little, yada yada, go to some parties, that's it. And then they said, and the winner is the Mars Volta. I was like, are you fucking kidding? And then the whole time I'm like, oh, we gotta go to the stage. Okay, we're gonna go to the stage to get our Grammys. But I thought, you know, oh, this is gonna give us one Grammy to the band. No, like, I didn't know that the band gets, everybody gets the Grammy, you know, because you're in the band, you know, like, so everybody walks, like Metallica, when they won their shit, mm-hmm. they walk, every member of the band walks with a statue. So they got me the statue. I'm like, what the fuck is this, man? And then I'm like in front of, you know, everybody, and they're like, you know, are you supposed to say something? I didn't say shit. I just like looking around and like, this is cool, man. And I was about to say something, but you know, everything is so quick. And I'm like, I'm gonna say something stupid. I just didn't say anything. I said a lot. I said a lot onto the press conferences. That's when I spoke a lot. I couldn't shut up about Coltrane and shit like that. Oh, you know, every single sucks, God, and this and that. And but the best part of it was like, so that it happened. The whole time, I just felt that the work I've done individually. I'm just being selfish right now. I'm just talking selfishly right now. Mm-hmm. That the work I've done, I've been doing. And then the sacrifices that I did, that my mom did, that my grandmother did, you know, it was that, man. It was like, because I knew my mom was gonna be, you know, she was gonna flip. And yeah, you know, as soon as she found out, she got the news, she was like, she cried for 2 hours and this and that. And so those things to me are for our parents, you know, and our family. And, you know, yeah, professionally, they give you a certain entitlement, you know, in the business. I don't know how much, because like everything, it has its pros and cons, you know. Yeah. But yeah, man, I'll tell you what, the best thing of that night was meeting B.B. King. Because B.B. King was right behind me.
Wow.
Yeah, so you lined up as an artist to go to the press conference. Mm-hmm. And I look back and I see these two towers, these two big muscular dudes. And one of them was pulling a wheelchair, and it was B.B. King on the wheelchair.
Wow.
You know, yeah, because B.B. King was a diabetic, so mm-hmm. he was having a lot of problems. And I looked, I'm like, man. I was about to tell you, I'm a big blues nut. I love blues, especially from that area. I was about to ask you about a guitar player right now. But anyways, I saw B.B. King, and I was like, oh, sir, man, blah, 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 this and that. They're like, oh, you guys did beautiful, kid. And that's, and he grabbed my hand, and I didn't wash my hand for freaking a whole year, man. I was like just kissing it and putting it in. Oh, fucking B.B. King, and like, God damn, you know, and I like could have, you know, everybody was into their rock and roll, you know, mentality. I was just thinking about B.B. King the whole time. Yeah, it was cool. You know, it was cool. And after that, you know, you start getting more nominations, and it becomes just a part of the job. I feel bad to say this, because it's not fair for the people that does not have a Grammy, you know, because I won the Grammy. So for me, it's easy to be like, oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, oh, oh. You know, I don't want to be that guy, you know, because it does matter, you know, and it does feel good. And, it, you know, but it becomes very quickly just a part of the job. It's just another thing of the job. It's just like, you know, like anything else, you know, like winning a gold medal in the Olympics. I don't know. If you ask anybody, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, or having a company approach you and say, we want to create a custom version of this instrument for you. I mean, I see Lee McKinney, you know, has that. You have it, and it's like,
yeah,
it's awesome. But at the same time, like you said, if you you guys have done the work for so long, and
it becomes part of the job. But yeah. I try not to think about it, because I've seen colleagues that do think about it that stop practicing. So I don't want to get into that. I don't want to be that. I don't want to be like, hey, I want this and this and that, so I'm good.
It probably pushed you harder in some ways, right? It made you push even harder.
Yeah, because a lot of your colleagues start calling you, a lot of your heroes start calling you to do some sessions. And I'm like, I don't want to fuck this up, so I better shed, And you start getting to that frequency of playing, You start getting calls from Lee McKinney or Tosin Abasi, or like, hey, man, you... I remember when Tosin, Javier, and I got in a call and be like, hey, let's get together to do an album. And then we got together into my apartment in Los Angeles every day except for one day for a month. We wrote everything and we recorded the Tram Lingua Franca in 3 days.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, we did 2 days, just us, and then Eric Moore recorded everything one day. And then it was, I guess you could say, 3.5 days, because I did overdubs and editing with Javier. Yeah, so I played the percussion for the rest of the album after Eric recorded his thing. So yeah, you start getting those calls, but a lot of your older colleagues stop calling you. You lose a lot of those. Or you can lose a lot of those if you're not careful, because they think they can afford you anymore.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Because I remember calling Luis Guerra and be like, hey man, how come you're not calling me anymore to do your sessions? He used to call me like once, at least twice a month to record for his movie scoring. Great writer. Luis Guerra. I did 18 and a half for Dan Mervish with him during the pandemic. And I had to call him, like, and he flat out told me, I cannot afford you, man. You have Grammys now. You're like, what do you mean? Just pay me what you pay me before. It's just a gig. It's just a job,
But you're a Grammy winner now.
Exactly. Yeah. Because legally you can ask for more. So yeah, you lose a lot of your homies,
Yeah.
So anyways, man, how do you, like, for instance, I'm not, just like you say, you're not a guitarist, I love drawing, and I like to write my memo. Obviously I write it in Spanish, but my memoir. But I take a lot of joy, because I know I have to research about things like that, or about things I want to talk about, or like right now I'm really into Dostoevsky,
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's Jordan Peterson's fault. But yeah, so I've been reading I'm almost done. So once I finish The Idiot, I'm done with Dostoevsky for a minute. And Nietzsche.
Yes.
And I mean, so anyways, you do all the research I'm never gonna write like you, or like others, or like Jordan Peterson, or like all these other guys, of course not, because that's their niche. That's their calling. But for instance, for somebody then has to go through that process, because I'm very interested on how other people do their craft, just like you. I'm assuming you do. That's one of the reasons one of the many reasons you do this type of podcast and talk to people such as Lee or other philosophers or people within the sport or jiu-jitsu masters or whatnot. Yeah. What will be the shedding like when you grab your guitar, in writing for you, besides reading a lot, besides going through your books or going back through research and onto whichever topic you're trying to unfold.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
And there's, like you say, it's kind of like with yours, there's so much to it, but Lots of times it comes down to trying to just perfect those first three sentences, that statement, almost like a hook, almost like you're that rhythm. And now that sets the pace for everything else, but you can go back to it. You can write it down and you look at it and you're like, that's trash. But then you come back the next day and look at it and say, actually, that part's not bad. And now you come back and you kind of wordsmith that. Or if you can get in that groove and you can attack it for 3 or 4 hours and really do that deep excavation. But for me, lots of times it starts with maybe a thought or just an experience, just like with this conversation we're having. And then something comes from that and you jot it down, just like with a melody. If you don't write it down, then you're going to forget it. You think you're going to remember it, but you won't.
No, of course not.
So I either write it down or I dictate it to my phone. That way I have it. And then if, again, you get those subjects and now you can put those things together. So if it's about adversity, if it's about discipline, if it's about humility, now they all kind of blend and they have that flavor and they dovetail. And then you just, for me, I just try to bleed onto the page and be as honest as I can, because that to me, just again, Dostoevsky, I mean, he's writing from this place of just so much poverty and so much like suffering, where Nietzsche, where he was just questioning everything. Mm-hmm. That's where we learn the most. So for you, that's why when I spoke to Leah, I loved how he was saying that adversity is what's informed the way that he writes everything. And when you hear Sugar on the Blade, Sugar on the Needle, you can feel it down in your soul. Or just like when I was telling you, when I heard you playing with him, I can feel this emotion just dripping off of what you play. And that's emotion. And that's something that you can never replace with AI. You can never replace with ChatGPT. You can never replace with, because people, you know, will borrow your stuff or just rip it off, which is a compliment. But that's, to me, is being able to convey that in a way that makes another human being really feel what I'm feeling. And I think that's what you do with your music. And I think that's why you're amazing.
Man, now that you mentioned AI, because I think what makes human art so beautiful is that it's imperfection. You see, like, even if you play classical music, you're going to fuck it up. I mean, I can take James Galway's flute concertos, performances, recording sessions, and I can tell you every time he fuck up. And it sounds beautiful. And it's almost a perfect performance, you know? Do you think AI is going to be able to try to replicate
that? Even if it tried, or even if it did so, it would still be artificial.
Yeah.
And there's something about, like you say, doing it organically and naturally,
right,
from the heart. And whether people realize it or not, I think they can feel it. Okay. And I think that once they're able to do that, that's why your music, the music that Lee creates, the writing that I'm trying to create, that's the goal, is to say, you know what? I'm human and I'm not perfect, but the imperfection is what creates the perfection in it, in my opinion.
Right.
It's that beauty of that. Again, it's like Japanese philosophy or jujitsu or anything. Mm. It's like whenever you mess up on that arm bar, that's when they started to learn umapalata. Mm. When you miss that and the guy rolls, now you're learning to go back into that arm bar and now you're flowing. So just like with jazz, just like when you're playing all these different styles, you feel it and you allow that momentum to build. And then you blend with it in a way that takes everyone to this direction, this place that they'd never been before. And it's this incredible experience that everybody's having in real time. And that's where the humanity makes the music and everything that people write so much more powerful, in my opinion.
Do you believe that certain topics, certain things in life are so, how can I create? Okay, for instance, if you get an idea of a topic you're writing about, and for some reason that idea seems useless, because, I don't know, maybe just, it feels pointless, useless, or it doesn't go anywhere. But why is it that sometimes the most simple ideas and so-called useless ideas are the more natural to navigate? I don't know if I'm expressing this correctly, but I don't know. Sometimes I feel like sometimes I have an idea, a melodic line, and it feels solid. If I listen to it at first hand, it's like, okay, that's it. But if I keep developing the idea in that particular moment, it seems like it doesn't want to go anywhere. It just wants to stay static in that point in time. And that's it. Don't evolve. Don't go back. Nothing. Just to be there. It's like the idea is scared of evolution.
And like you said, there's times when we have that lick or we have that passage or we have that thing, and then we walk away from it. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks later, it hits. Mm-hmm. And you come back to it. And now it's like these pieces of the puzzle sort of fall together. Mm-hmm. Or you take these, like you said, these three areas that don't connect at all. Uh-huh. But then all of a sudden, if you either change the key or you use something chromatic to connect them, mm-hmm. now they mesh into this beautiful thing that you wouldn't have gotten any other way.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about let it go. Even though you're doing the shedding, even though you're there for your muse, you know, and working, writing, or, you know, whatever your trade might be. But sometimes I feel like you have to just let it go. Any technicality you may be to create that part of, I don't know, to create a method of writing or a method of composing or if you're trying to do a string quintet and the idea doesn't go anywhere. I think sometimes it's, you just have to let it go. You just have to let it go and be in that moment and just not think so much about rules, which is very hard for me to say because I'm very rule-oriented. I have to give myself parameters of what are my parameters. Like I need, this is my melody, this is the harmony, the chord changes, this is the rhythm at bay, you know. And I can only work with, I want to work and create a great thing, which is these patterns and see where it takes me. I feel like I work better and create better things. When I have let it go, at that moment, when I finish the improvisation over, how do I say? Let's say Giant Steps by Coltrane, and I just let it go. I just let it go. I feel like at the end of that moment, I feel like I play like shit. And then I hear the recording, and I'm like, what the fuck? That was great. That was great. So obviously, yeah, I wouldn't be able to do this if I didn't do the prior shedding. I get it. You know, I get it. But at one point, you should just let it go all the time or search for that spiritual avenue.
Yes.
You know, of that spiritual avenue as part of your shedding.
That's it. You know, it's almost like you can be surgical with it and just unleash it, because what you're describing is you weren't playing that music. That music was playing you.
Totally.
I'm not writing the words. The words are writing me. Mm-hmm. And now it just comes out. And then you step away. Yeah. You're like you said, it's the muse. It's almost like you're a vessel and it just comes out. But you had to have all that technical prowess, all that knowledge, all those gigs in Chihuahua or in New York getting a Grammy. Mm-hmm. To give you the capacity to be able to convey it, because otherwise it wouldn't have come out the way it did.
Now, when you write in that type of environment, it's just like, do you write on paper or you write on your typing?
My handwriting is horrible, so I have to type it. But once you're there, really? And you're just kind of going, for me, all of a sudden you just step away and you look at it and you say, oh, wow.
Okay.
And it's beautiful when it happens. But there are also days when you do it and you're like, this is garbage. I'm garbage. I'm shutting my computer. Nobody's going to read my book. I'm a hack. I suck. And Stephen Pressfield and Robert Greene talk about, they say every time they begin, like, I have that fear that nobody's going to listen to this or nobody's going to buy this or that this is shit. And that's good, because that keeps us honest and it makes us earn it every time we sit down.
It probably feels great, even if you're writing it by hand or typing it, to just you're not really thinking. You're like literally spelling everything, spelling everything onto your computer or the paper, you know?
Yeah. But I have to write 10 pages of shit before I get to that point. I have to write. Yeah.
So, I mean,
but once you're there, it's worth it.
Yeah.
I love it. Man, listen, I think this is a great place for us to put a bow on this.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, it's flown by. I know. Where can I send people to learn about you? We can go to Instagram. We can go to Spotify.
Yeah, go to all that. Go to Instagram, go to Spotify, Apple Music, our label. And one of my labels just put a lot of the playlist there on Spotify.
Beautiful.
I think the playlist is called This is Adrian. Awesome. This is Adrian Terrazas Gonzalez. And then you can get a good chunk of it. Or you can just go to my Instagram, and we're working right now on the YouTube channel. Also, if you follow any of my other colleagues like Lee or Animals with Leaders guys or Born of Osiris guys, we're good at throwing people at each other and helping each other. So we're a good group of like a little clique. So
I love it.
So yeah, man. So yeah, just go to Spotify and I'll have shows there or what I do with the video game and this and that, you know?
Perfect. And we'll link all that in the show notes for everybody so we give you all
that. To you.
Thank you, brother. Man. Thank you for the time.
Marcus, thank you so much, man. It's been a long, long waiting to do this.
And we'll do it again. We'll do another one in the future,
please.
Hey? Sound good?
Thanks, man.
I appreciate you.
Thank you, Anderson. You too, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Okta Nonverba. If this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Okta Nonverba Inner Circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.